Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present the 52nd Annual University Lecture, originally recorded and broadcast last fall. Tonight's lecturer is the Borden Parker Bound Professor of Philosophy, University Professor Stanley Rosen. Professor Rosen is the author of 13 books on philosophy, most recently The Elusiveness of the Ordinary. He is also a past president of the Metaphysical Society of America. Professor Rosen spoke on Comfortable Virtue, Remarks on the Enlightenment. He was introduced by Provost Dennis Burkey. Here in part is what Provost Burkey said, followed by Professor Stanley Rosen giving the annual university lecture.
Tonight's speaker has been described by other of his colleagues and by his students as a superb teacher, amazingly funny, and I'm quoting now, and an excellent listener. Nonetheless, I'm told there's an oft-told tale about a reply he gave to a student long ago who had expressed concern about an upcoming oral examination with him. When asked what the exam would be like, Rosen is reputed to have said, "You'll come to my office, I'll ask you a question, then I'll answer the question." The truth is, I can't stand for anyone else to talk. But in relating this story, I was told, be sure to be certain to emphasize that the impulse for this answer comes from an incredibly deep intellectual generosity, a nature that seeks to go outward, to communicate. And that nature is paired with a commitment to being crystal clear about enormously complex subjects. I give you Stanley Rosen.
I'm grateful and honored to be invited to speak to you about some aspect of my philosophical work. A question that has interested me continuously for 50 years is that of the differences between ancient and modern philosophy. This enormous question may be narrowed somewhat by rephrasing it as the investigation of the fate of the modern European Enlightenment. In yet another variation, the question takes the form of a frequently asserted conviction that the modern epoch of Western European civilization is drawing to an end, or has already ended, and so that we are now entering into the postmodern epoch. Is there any plausibility to this assertion? In order to address this set of questions properly, it would be necessary to deliver a series of lectures, not just one. Since I cannot impose upon your patience for the next several months, much as I would like to, I have decided that discretion is the better part of valor, and I'll restrict myself to just one aspect of this complicated situation. My topic is the transformation effected in the classical conception of virtue by the great founding figures of the modern age through their attempt to combine virtue with material comfort. The underlying question is, of course, whether this combination is viable or whether the desire for comfort will not always supervene over moral and political excellence. The expression quarrel between the ancients and moderns is associated primarily with a debate about the relative ranking of ancient and modern poetry. But this is not the deepest or most comprehensive version of the quarrel, which is engaged not at the level of poetry, but rather of a new conception of the possibilities of human existence, or in other words, of what constitutes the good life. The quarrel blossoms in the 17th and 18th centuries under the powerful influence of mathematical and experimental science. The motto of the modern epoch is Descartes' famous assertion, indeed assurance, that thanks to the knowledge of the new physics, we can employ the various procedures of artisans and, quote, thus render ourselves as masters and possessors of nature, end quote. In the present context, what interests me in particular about the scientific and technological revolution of which Descartes is one of the chief generals, is the thesis that the new science will not only gratify our desire to know the truth, but will also be the means of acquiring knowledge that, as Descartes says, is extremely useful for life. It remained for the second half of the 20th century to provide a historical confirmation of the full implications of what Descartes had in mind. I'm thinking especially, of course, about the explosion in the biological sciences and the debate about stem cell research and cloning. Despite the extraordinary advance of useful knowledge, however, there are today widespread doubts about the values of late modern life and the prospects for what used to be called the pursuit of happiness. In this lecture, I'm interested in the causes of these doubts, and still more specifically, in the typical arguments by which the most influential modern thinkers founded a new conception of the place of material comfort in the good life. I shall focus this evening on the problem of the difference between ancient and modern virtue. The term virtue means literally excellence, of which two kinds are, on the one hand, political, and on the other, moral. It's with these two terms, which must be carefully distinguished, that we will be primarily concerned: political and moral virtue. For the sake of clarity of exposition, I will employ two figures, Montesquieu and Hume, as examples of the modern position that first comes to special prominence in the writings of John Locke. The key premises here are, first, the desire for comfortable survival through the legally protected enjoyment of private property, the fruit of one's labor, and second, the superiority of peace to war. This latter superiority, in turn, leads to a depreciation of the ancient sense of political virtue as martial prowess, and eventually to the shift from aristocratic to middle-class conceptions of the good life. The simplest way in which to express the characteristically modern revision of classical virtue, in both the political and moral senses of that term, is to note a shift in emphasis from the gentleman to the businessman. It's often been observed that there is a shift in the 18th century, away from the austere morality and aristocratic sense of virtue of the ancients, to the conception of virtue that is compatible with comfortable self-preservation. For example, as Paul Ray has shown in detail, the conception of virtue shared by the American founding fathers was not that of the Greek city-state, as is claimed by Pocock and those who follow him, but rather the private and commerce-oriented virtue of the Enlightenment. In this conception of virtue, independence, diligence, and frugality replace magnanimity, courage, and martial valor. This new conception of virtue leads to a partial rehabilitation of labor. Let me interpolate here a terminological distinction. For the most part, I shall use the English word labor to designate physical toil, and work to stand for the productive toil of the spirit, including the imagination and the intellect. The distinction I have in mind is expressed in German, for example, as that between Arbeit and Werk. To continue, the prehistory of the rehabilitation of labor lies in the shift from the classical conception of labor as vulgar to the biblical conception of labor as the punishment for original sin. Whereas sin seems even worse than vulgarity, it is in fact the condition for the opportunity of redemption through suffering. I mentioned the much-discussed case of the connection between Protestantism and the rise of capitalism, in which thinkers like Max Weber and R.H. Tawney saw labor as the discharge of original sin, that is, in the Calvinist formulation, as a sign that one has been granted salvation by the grace of God. This is a disputed contention, but I don't believe that it can be entirely wrong. At a deeper level, the idea of salvation through labor can be seen in its secular form in the new importance of cognitive work in 19th century philosophy. That is, the view that reality is a construction of the process of cognition itself. This is the direct ancestor of the contemporary doctrine of reality as a social construction. By transforming nature into our own image, we free ourselves from bondage, and by so doing, we open up the possibility of changing that image. As it turns out, this increases our toil rather than diminishes it. It's hard work to keep nature enslaved. Each step forward in our own mastery seems to intensify the dangers of revolt. The celebration of work also has something important to do with the gradual lowering in the status of happiness in the 19th century. Happiness, as the ancients emphasized, is a state of leisure. For the modern view, I'll quote Nietzsche's Zarathustra, the prophet of the Superman, who cries out at the climax of his revelation, "My suffering and my pity for suffering, what does it matter? Am I concerned with happiness? I'm concerned with my work." That's a typically modern statement. For the moderate school of the 18th century Enlightenment, however, represented by Montesquieu and Hume, to whom I shall turn shortly, the labor of commerce and manufacture does not have such dangerous consequences for human happiness, because these 18th century figures do not seem to have thought through the effect of modern science and technology in the multiplying and vulgarizing of our passions and desires. To this, one may add that their generally aristocratic tendencies, that is to say, those of Hume and Montesquieu, their generally aristocratic tendencies, as well as the relatively restrained development of technology in their time, did not move them to be greatly concerned with the laboring class in the manner of the 19th century. Thinkers like Montesquieu and Hume thus rather paradoxically combine the Aristotelian emphasis on moderation with a non-Aristotelian respect for wealth and comfort. Unfortunately, despite the elegance with which it is stated, the resulting combination proves to be unstable. If it was not previously clear, the instability becomes unmistakable in the period of the French Revolution and the subsequent rise of the bourgeoisie in the 19th century. The question, then, is what happens to our conception of happiness in the shift from moderate to extreme technological, industrial, and commercial advance? Crucial to this question is the fact that man cannot become the master and possessor of nature, as Descartes put it, without disenfranchising the previous master, namely God. There now seems to be no limit on what we can become. Side by side with the increased importance of comfort is the growing restlessness to become more than we are, a restlessness that leads paradoxically to increased physical labor and spiritual or intellectual work. The pursuit of comfort thus generates uncomfortable toil, or as Leo Strauss once put the point with respect to Locke's political philosophy, the joyless quest for joy. The hard work of proving that one is worthy of salvation through predestination is now transformed into the infinitely harder work of replacing one paradigm of salvation with another, and indeed with an endless stream of paradigms. The concept of nature is soon replaced by that of the history of nature. In an assertion repeated by one modern thinker after another, we know only what we make. Nature is thus itself historicized. It turns into the history of human production. As it has turned out, there is reason to believe that apparently endless historical production leads to exhaustion and sadness or anxiety rather than to happiness. In the language of theoretical philosophy, the classical doctrine of essences and substances as existing independently of the human mind is replaced by concepts like that of models or theories. This last term, namely theories, is now used in the sense of interpretation, and thus a laying down to nature of the order she must follow if we are to be able to command her. A theory is now a construction, not as it meant in classical times, a view of eternity, a gazing upon the eternal order. We might refer to this new sense of theory as ontological production. It has its social and political corollary in manufacture and commerce. Instead of discovering a standard in nature for the good life, we employ science and theoretical philosophy to set our own standards to nature. Having tried to indicate the interconnection between theory and production in the development of the modern epoch, I'll concentrate henceforth on practice, and so on the emancipation of the passions and the interests, as Albert Hirschman entitles his well-known and valuable study of this phenomenon. So I turn now to the first of my two examples of the moderate Enlightenment, in order to illustrate the reasoning by which the modern emphasis upon utility and material comfort was held to lead to a new conception of political and moral virtue. We shall, I believe, discover certain flaws of judgment, not the same thing as logical errors, flaws of judgment that made inevitable the failure of the new conception to accomplish its goals. Montesquieu, the great political thinker of the mid-18th century, whose masterpiece is entitled On the Spirit of the Laws, 1748, is one of numerous philosophers of the period who tried to demonstrate the analogy between physical and political science. We shall, however, be concerned with the political as contrasted with the scientific aspect of his teaching. The first thing to be said is that Montesquieu, like many of his greatest contemporaries and direct successors, did not at all deny the superiority of the ancient conception of political virtue, by which he means patriotism and the doing of splendid deeds for the preservation of the city-state. In an important passage from The Spirit of the Laws, Montesquieu says, quote, Greek statesmen, he means ancient Greeks, of course, Greek statesmen who lived in a popular government recognized no other force that could sustain the polity than that of virtue. Today's statesmen speak to us of nothing but manufactures, commerce, finances, riches, and even of luxury. A similar view will be expressed 2 years later by Rousseau in his first discourse, where he argues that the human soul has been corrupted in accord with the advance of the sciences and arts. I quote, "The ancient statesmen spoke without cessation of morals and virtue. Ours speak of nothing but commerce and money." One can easily provide a wide range of passages in Montesquieu that assert the superiority of the ancients to the moderns. As Thomas Pangle brings out convincingly, however, there's an ambiguity in Montesquieu's praise of the virtue of the ancients. By virtue, Montesquieu refers neither to morality nor to religion, but to the political attributes of the love of country and equality. In the case of the virtuous classical republics, this is connected to the institution of a martial spirit in which life is marked, as Montesquieu interprets it, by monastic obedience, as in the case of Sparta. Freedom of the Athenian sort, on the other hand, leads to faction, empire, and slavery. Differently stated, the expansion of commerce and manufacture in Athens was connected to the development of an extraordinary artistic, scientific, and philosophical culture. But the prevailing sense of political virtue in ancient Athens was less pure than that of Sparta, and so could not overcome the disadvantages of an excited lifestyle that culminated necessarily in empire and self-destruction. According to Montesquieu, the moderns are superior to the ancients because they are gentler and more pacific. Gentler and more pacific. This is a consequence of several factors, two of which are the difference between paganism and Christianity and the greater power of modern science and technology. As we shall see, Montesquieu approves of the replacement of the republican virtue of the ancients by the very modern spirit of commerce that he seemed initially to denigrate. This judgment is rooted in his preference for peace to war, a judgment that not only allows but requires us to sacrifice the performance of extraordinary deeds of patriotic valor, quote, that we no longer see today, and which patriotic deeds of the ancients astound our small souls. So I like to underline that. Montesquieu sees modern man, that is to say, first half of the 18th century, as having a small soul in comparison with the ancients. And yet this small soul will be proved finally to be superior to the ancients in a crucial fact, in a crucial way, namely with respect to the blending of comfort and virtue in everyday life. I must comment at this point on the fact that history has not supported, at least not in my view, Montesquieu's central thesis that commerce and the pursuit of material comfort lead to peace rather than to a kind of Athenian collapse. Nevertheless, his view is not without its influential representatives today. We read the same point constantly in the newspapers. In order to maintain peace with a country, it's necessary to establish trade relations with them. I think that's a very common view today. Even less convincing, after the bloody history of the 20th century, is the claim that modern societies are gentler than those of the ancients. One could say that in 1748, not, I'm afraid, in 2002. In general, Montesquieu seems to have overestimated the human capacity to inflect the stream of the passions and the interests into gentler waters. But this does not alter the historical importance of his thesis, which, of course, was not his alone, and the role it has played in shaping the post-Enlightenment world. I'll cite a typical passage in which Montesquieu explains the superiority of the moderns to the ancients. Finally, the superiority of the moderns to the ancients. In this passage, he's speaking of the superiority of the modern notion of the rights of man to that of the ancient Romans. The Romans destroyed conquered peoples, whereas the moderns, says Montesquieu, continue to govern them according to their laws. Montesquieu leaves it to the reader to judge, quote, to what point we have become better. He goes on to say, one must here render homage to modern times, les temps modernes, to present to present-day reason, to contemporary religion, to our philosophy, to our mores, end quote. But let me summarize the line of reflection to this point. It's true that Montesquieu contrasts the extraordinary merits of ancient Greek political institutions, and thus of Greek education and patriotism, contrasts that favorably with, quote, the dregs and the corruption of our modern times, end quote. In the very next chapter, however, he makes it clear that the Greek institutions can be employed effectively only in a small state, quote, in which one may provide a general education and bring up the people as one family, end quote. If we think about Montesquieu's argument, we understand him to be saying that the very forces that caused small city-states to combine into or to be assimilated by large nations have also brought about a great improvement in morality. And this dialectical progress, in turn, has opened up a certain political advantage to modernity as well. I choose the term dialectical here to bring out the striking fact that superiority and inferiority are not distinct, but reciprocally related. The very increase in the size of the state and the material advance that marks the modern epoch have made our souls small. But this smallness, exemplified by the shift from war to peaceful commerce, has made us safer, more humane, and more comfortable. Modern moral and political virtue, although low in one sense, is high in another. And Montesquieu opts for the moderns, despite his perception of the outstanding virtue of the ancients, political virtue. I need to cite at this point a brilliant passage from the notebooks of a later figure, the great 19th century Italian poet and thinker, Leopardi. This passage, which dates from 1820, states eloquently the dialectical situation I've just summarized. I quote Leopardi. "The whole world is of the opinion that the ancients were superior to us, as much the elderly, who for that reason praise the ancients, as the young, who for that reason disdain them. In this it is certain that the world makes no mistake. It is certain, however, that even though people today don't think about it, they recognize and confess every day their own deterioration. And indeed, not only in this expression, but in 100 other ways. And all the same, it never enters into their minds to turn back. On the contrary, it's thought to be dishonorable not to go always further forward. And by one of the customary contradictions, they persuade themselves and take it as indubitable that through advancing, they will become better, and that it is not possible to become better except by advancing. And they estimate that to retrace one's steps is to be lost." End quote. Two generations later, Nietzsche, perhaps the most powerful critic of the decay of the late modern European spirit, will give substantially the same diagnosis as Leopardi, but with one crucial difference. For Nietzsche, as he says, I quote him, "man is not a crab. He cannot walk backwards," in other words. "We have no choice but to go forward into the valley of nihilism. Only by total destruction of our culture will the ground be cleared for a new and vital beginning." Leopardi, you could say, despairs. Nietzsche is invigorated by what he takes to be the decay of the modern spirit, and sees that as an opportunity for a radical revolution and transformation of not just values, but all of society. Perhaps we can say that Leopardi discerns a flaw in the dialectical thinking of the great masters of the Enlightenment. One finds in figures as diverse as Adam Smith and Immanuel Kant a doctrine of the dialectic of human desire, according to which the selfish efforts by individual persons to satisfy their desires will lead to public order and virtue. This is substantially the teaching that we've elicited from Montesquieu. He elaborates it, however, in a much more subtle and complicated way than most. The bluntest and therefore rather oversimplified version of that teaching is perhaps Mandeville's slogan, "private vices, public virtues." We've just heard Leopardi's judgment on this thesis. There's been a decline in virtue and individual character in comparison with the ancients. Many of the leading personalities of the Enlightenment grant this decline, but are convinced that by moving deeper into its depths, we will somehow become better. Forward into nihilism, as Nietzsche puts it. We can't go backwards. We can't return to the past. We must go forward in the hope that we'll come out of the darkness and into a new light. This is what Hegel means by his attribution to history of the cunning of reason. And it's stated by Nietzsche with his usual exaggerated rhetoric in the advice to the crabmen, or conservatives, as he also calls them. One could almost say that worse is better, or that things must become worse in order to improve. Now, to come back to Montesquieu, he recognizes that the striving for comfortable self-preservation is itself just. It's not vulgar, simply. It's also just. Justice is vulgar, if I may interpret Montesquieu. Not me. If the FBI is present, I didn't say that in my own voice. For this reason, when speaking in the spirit of the laws of revolutions in the conduct of international commerce, Montesquieu criticizes Aristotle for condemning profit through interest in moneylending, usury. Montesquieu criticizes Aristotle for condemning it. This condemnation, he says, led to the restriction of commerce to the lowest classes and even to criminals. He then adds, quote, "Every time that one forbids something that is naturally permitted or necessary, one succeeds only in making dishonest men of those who engage in it." This situation, Montesquieu says, was transformed through the mediation of the Jews, who developed commerce, and who in particular invented the letter of exchange. This in turn led to the confiscation of Jewish wealth by the aristocracy, and to the subsequent intervention by national governments in order to regulate the process. To make a long story short, the imprudence of political violence, and in particular the Machiavellianism of coup d'etat, must be replaced by moderation. Montesquieu attempts to replace the consequences of the harsh and warlike political virtue of the ancients, which is closely associated with an aristocratic ethos, by peace and what he says in the French, calls in French douceur de vivre, something like the softness or sweetness of life. In so doing, he is prepared to lower the standard of political virtue, to endorse modernity, in other words, and to change our conception of moral virtue as well. The following passage will help us to understand how Montesquieu attempts to reconcile ancient virtue with modern comfort. I quote, "It's true that whenever a democracy is founded upon commerce, it may very well happen that particular citizens have great wealth, and yet that the mores are not corrupted. This is because the spirit of commerce carries with it the spirit of frugality, economy, moderation, work, judiciousness, tranquility, order, and law." Sounds just like the Enron Corporation, doesn't it? "Thus, as long as this spirit subsists, the fortunes that it produces have no bad effect. As long as people are moderate, it's all right to have multi-billionaires. Evil arises whenever the excess of the wealth destroys that spirit of commerce. One sees born instantly the disorders of inequality, which were not previously perceptible." We thus find in Montesquieu a curiously Aristotelian emphasis upon the importance of moderation and a licensing of the accumulation of large fortunes, something which John Locke, in the way of his teacher, also endorsed. I quote Montesquieu, "The democracy and the aristocracy are not free states by their nature. Political liberty is found only in moderate governments," end quote. And again, quote, "In sum, I say, and it seems to me that I have not produced this work, namely the spirit of the laws, except to prove that the spirit of moderation must be that of the legislator." That phrase could have been written by Aristotle. In fact, it was written by Aristotle. "The political good, like the moral good," Montesquieu goes on, "is found always between two limits," end quote. So there's Montesquieu's praise of moderation. But Montesquieu's moderation, unlike that of Aristotle, is derived not from moral virtue, but from the spirit of commerce. That's the interesting thing, I think. Whatever you think of it, that's the striking thing. Montesquieu's moderation is derived from the spirit of commerce. Quote, "Commerce heals destructive prejudices. Commerce heals destructive prejudices. And it's almost a general rule that wherever there are mild mores, there is commerce. And wherever there is commerce, there are mild mores. One should therefore not be at all surprised if our mores are less ferocious than they used to be." And a few lines later, "One may say that the laws of commerce perfect mores for the same reason that these same laws result in the loss of mores. Commerce corrupts pure mores. That was the subject of Plato's complaints. It polishes and softens barbarous mores, as we see every day." In other words, the Greeks were pure, so to speak, relatively at least to us. Therefore, commerce had a bad effect on them. We are already debased. Therefore, commerce will have a good effect on us. That's an interesting dialectical move. Once more, the dialectical nature of Montesquieu's reasoning is evident. It is our roughness or barbarous manners that enable us to live more mildly or softly than did the ancients. Commerce is good for us because we are bad, and it is our inferiority to the ancients that makes it possible for the dialectic of desire to carry out its function. Dialectic is all very well, but it's incumbent upon us not to allow it to collapse into confusion. So let us assume that our barbarism will be mitigated, as Montesquieu says, by the desire to satisfy our passion for the necessities and luxuries of everyday life. Is it not clear that the pursuit of material comfort not only civilizes us, as Montesquieu claims, but that it also makes us less moderate in our appetites? To me, that's obvious. I mean, it's nothing that I would try to prove philosophically. It's a question of one's experience in life. I believe it is fair to add that this increasing immoderation will be accompanied by a diminution in our concern for honor. Why then does Montesquieu seem to rule out the possibility that in our pursuit of worldly goods, we will become less gentle and more barbarous, more accustomed to luxury, and thus more accessible to vice? It's all very well to praise moderation, but one should not be misled into an excessive attribution of moderation to the historical process. Montesquieu is, of course, aware of the inner tension between commerce and virtue. He warns us that if commerce comes to dominate the spirit of a nation, quote, one traffics in all human actions. Everything has its price, as we say today. And in all human morals, the smallest things demanded by humanity are done or provided for by money, end quote. This attachment to money is inseparable from a taste for luxury, which is contrary to the all-important spirit of moderation. It's a contradiction in Montesquieu's thought, which he never resolved. The attachment to money is inseparable from a taste for luxury, which is contrary to the all-important spirit of moderation and which corrupts virtue by pleasure, as well as leading to the extinction of the love of the public good and its replacement by private interest. On the other hand, luxury leads also to the perfection of the arts, as is plain, according to Montesquieu, from ancient history. The arts, he says, must be associated with the corruption or decadence of political life. As Montesquieu himself says, quote, the less there is luxury in a republic, the more perfect it is, end quote. Incidentally, I should have made that clear a moment ago, when Montesquieu links commerce and the perfection of the arts, he's not talking about painting, music, and poetry by arts. He means what the Greeks call technai, or what we call the arts and crafts. He's clearly thinking of the arts that contribute to the general comfort of life. This may be inferred from his view that the greatest poetry was produced not by moderns, but by Homer, at a time of very primitive economic activity. In Montesquieu's view, the ancient city in which the arts were carried farthest was Corinth, not Athens. This remark is followed by a favorable reference to the Corinthian temple of Venus, in which he says, more than 1,000 courtesans were consecrated, end quote. And the perfection of the arts, that's the kind of art that Montesquieu is approving of, and the perfection of the arts occurred in the Roman Empire simultaneously with the rejection of the old Roman scorn for commerce, thanks to the corruption introduced through trade with Arabia and India, which he says was of the same date as the fall of their republic, end quote. Well, since commerce leads to luxury, and because both are indispensable to the doctrine of comfortable virtue, it's not possible to preserve Montesquieu's dialectic from inner incoherence. The causes of the superiority of the modern state to the ancient city are also the causes of the decline and eventual destruction of the modern state. I believe that the situation worsens if we factor in what Montesquieu could not have anticipated, the multiplying effect on the desire for luxury of the full explosion of scientific and technological progress in the 19th and 20th centuries. There's a subterranean connection in Montesquieu's account between commerce, the cultivation of the comfortable arts, and the decline in political virtue. I turn now to a second example of Enlightenment moderation in the service of comfortable virtue. David Hume, and I'll discuss very briefly three of his essays, which were published in 1742 and 1752, just about the time that Montesquieu was writing. The first essay, Of Civil Liberty, precedes the publication of Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws by 6 years. I'm primarily interested in the view expressed in this essay about commerce. To begin with, Hume distinguishes between the views of the ancients and the moderns with respect to the importance attributed to trade. I quote Hume, "Trade was never esteemed an affair of state till the last century," that is to say the 17th century, "and there scarcely is any ancient writer on politics who has made mention of it. Even the Italians have kept a profound silence with regard to it. Though it has now," he's thinking of the Venetian Empire, which is a great commercial empire, a little bit earlier than this, "though it has now engaged the chief attention," namely commerce, "it has now engaged the chief attention as well of ministers of state as of speculative reasoners." He's thinking of Adam Smith, probably, his friend. "The great opulence, grandeur, and military achievements of the two maritime powers," Hume goes on to say, namely Holland and England, seem first to have instructed mankind in the importance of an extensive commerce. The great empires of Holland and England seem first to have instructed mankind in the importance of an extensive commerce. A few pages later, Hume says that, quote, it has become an established opinion that commerce can never flourish but in a free government, end quote. Whereas Montesquieu approves in the last analysis of the lowering or diluting of political virtue by the spirit of commerce, Hume, in effect, connects the superiority of modern virtue with the spirit of commerce. Commerce requires freedom. Refinement and learning do not. Commerce requires freedom. Refinement and learning do not. In the continuation of this same passage, Hume develops this point. He says that, quote, notwithstanding the efforts of the French, there's something hurtful to commerce inherent in the very nature of absolute government. Commerce, therefore, in my opinion, is apt to decay in absolute governments, not because it is there less secure, but because it is less honorable. A subordination of ranks is absolutely necessary to the support of monarchy. A subordination of ranks is absolutely necessary to the support of monarchy. Birth, titles, and place must be honored above industry and riches. And while these notions prevail, all the considerable traders will be tempted to throw up their commerce in order to purchase some of these employments to which privileges and honors are annexed. End quote. One has only to think of the novels of Jane Austen, Anthony Trollope, and Henry James, to mention the three that interest me most, in order to trace the history of the inevitable conquest of honor by commerce, and so of political virtue by comfort. As for Hume, the conflict between avarice and honor does not lead him to condemn commerce. He claims that the greater importance given to commerce in modern times is a sign of the greater freedom enjoyed by the moderns in comparison to the ancients, whereas the same cannot be said of progress in the arts. Quote, since I am upon this head of the alterations which time has produced or may produce in politics, I must observe that all kinds of government, free and absolute, seem to have undergone in modern times a great change for the better with regard both to foreign and domestic management. The balance of power is a secret in politics fully known only to the present age. The balance of power is a secret in politics fully known only to the present age. And I must add that the internal police of states has also received great improvements within the last century. End quote. This passage suggests that for Hume, freedom and monarchy are not mutually exclusive. He goes on to say that modern monarchical government, quote, seems to have made the greatest advances toward perfection. It may now be affirmed of civilized monarchies what was formerly said of republics alone, that they are a government of laws, not of men. End quote. Hume also conjectures that there is a source of improvement in monarchies and degeneracy in popular governments, which in time will bring these forms of government still nearer to equality. Monarchies, he says, degenerate, that is, are stimulated to move closer to popular principles because of the wasteful and unfair method of collecting taxes, whereas in popular governments, the impetus towards monarchy is, quote, the practice of contracting debt and mortgaging the public revenues, end quote. As we can rephrase Hume's point, a sound fiscal policy is one that preserves a balance of power between the monarchical and republican elements in one's nation. Moderation in the management of material wealth thus plays the role in his thought that is filled by moderation of the passions in the political teachings of Aristotle. Of course, Hume is also an advocate of the moderation of the passions, but by making virtue a political partner of elegance and comfort, the result from an Aristotelian standpoint is the demotion of virtue and the promotion of comfort. This is, I think, plain from an essay, the last I'll consider, of Hume's, entitled Of Commerce, in which Hume connects comfort with the happiness of the citizens. He says, quote, the greatness of a state and the happiness of its subjects, how independent soever they may be supposed in certain respects, are commonly allowed to be inseparable with regard to commerce. The greatness of a state and the happiness of its subjects are commonly allowed to be inseparable with regard to commerce. And as private men receive greater security in the possession of their trade and riches from the power of the public, so the public becomes powerful in proportion to the opulence and extensive commerce of private men. The arts of luxury, namely the production of superfluous or not strictly necessary goods, quote, add to the happiness of the state. Superfluous luxuries add to the happiness of the state by increasing the opportunity of enjoyment for the private citizens. Furthermore, the conflict between the interest of the sovereign and that of the private citizen produces a kind of balance of power within the state. Quote, as the ambition of the sovereign must entrench on the luxury of individuals, so the luxury of individuals must diminish the force and check the ambition of the sovereign, end quote. A balance of power, then, between the sovereign and the people leads, according to Hume, to a reciprocal limitation on the amount of wealth and luxury possessed by each, and indirectly on the pursuit of wealth and luxury of the state as a whole. It would not be wrong to refer to this as a sign of Hume's residual Aristotelianism, but it would be entirely mistaken to see Hume as advocating a return to the political doctrines and practices of the ancients. In considering whether modern sovereigns, quote, may not return to the maxims of ancient policy, end quote, and cater to their own interests rather than to the happiness of their subjects, that is, become tyrants, he replies, quote, that it appears to me almost impossible to go back to the ancient political ways. It appears to me almost impossible, and that because ancient policy was violent and contrary to the more natural and usual course of things, Hume. Again, it's not so important whether Hume's views and Montesquieu's views were historically accurate. It's important for us in thinking about their advice. But first, we want to understand what their advice was. They saw the ancient world as violent, insecure, and uncomfortable. The modern world was peaceful, secure, and comfortable. So if we have to pay a little bit of price in moral virtue, so what? That's somewhat, well, that's the way we would say it in Cleveland, Ohio. But it approximates to what Hume is saying. The political virtue of the ancients, just as we saw in Montesquieu, is warlike, whereas modern politics is peaceful. This is to say that modern politics removes the distortion through which the ancient political thinkers viewed human nature. There's no reference here to the extreme progressivism and mastery of nature introduced by Descartes, for example. But neither is there a belief in the superiority of ancient political virtue to the modern version. Hume is an even greater partisan of peace than Montesquieu, who is still capable of perceiving the smallness of the modern soul. Montesquieu is, in a way, disgusted, like any good aristocrat would be, of the vulgarity and smallness of the modern soul. Draft dodgers, things of that sort. I mean, not that they had that in the 18th century, but I'm trying to bring up a contemporary example. It is for Hume the Spartans and the Romans, not the moderns, but the Spartans and the Romans who exemplify violence against nature, not the modern commercial nations. Quote, now according to the most natural course of things, industry and arts and trade increase the power of the sovereign as well as the happiness of the subjects. And that policy is violent, which aggrandizes the public by the poverty of individuals. Spartan simplicity. In other words, private persons must be free to accumulate wealth to the extent of their ability to do so, exactly as John Locke taught in the 17th century, compatible with the balance of power between the rich and the poor, or the monarchic and the republican elements of the state. We have to get that balance, but otherwise we're free to accumulate as much as we like. Well, it remains to say a word about Hume's treatment of luxury. In an essay called On Refinement in the Arts, Hume begins with the assertion that the gratification of the senses is not itself a vice. The gratification of the senses is not itself a vice, as it would have been, for example, for Plato or Aristotle. And he proceeds to defend innocent luxury, which I would interpret as a corollary of comfortable virtue. Hume offers to prove, first, that the ages of refinement are both the happiest and most virtuous. Second, that wherever luxury ceases to be innocent, it also ceases to be beneficial, and when carried a degree too far, is a quality pernicious, though perhaps not the most pernicious, to political society. The main point of his argument is that when industry and the arts flourish, men are kept busy and rewarded with pleasure and an invigorated intellect, quote, and by an assiduity in honest industry. The mind both satisfies its natural appetites and prevents the growth of unnatural ones, which commonly spring up when nourished by ease and idleness. No one could accuse Hume of a sensualist approach to luxury for arguing that progress in the fine arts makes men more sociable. What remains opaque in his argument, however, is the tacit premise that innocent luxury sustains peace. We would require a much more detailed analysis of innocence in order to be confident that the connection between war and beauty characteristic not only of ancient Athens, but also of Renaissance Italy, will not reassert itself in the elegant 18th century. Hume seems, again like Montesquieu, to have no sense that political balance and moderation may be dissolved by the scientific and technological revolution that's just around the corner. For Hume, as for most of the key figures of the Enlightenment, there's a general conviction that knowledge and art, when combined with comfort, point towards political and moral virtue, and so to peace. Not the same kind of political and moral virtue as in the ancient world, but, as I said before, secure, more comfortable, and in a way more just. Hume writes, quote, "Thus industry, knowledge, and humanity are linked together by an indissoluble chain and are found from experience as well as reason to be peculiar to the more polished and what are commonly denominated the more luxurious ages," end quote. He then adds that there are no accompanying disadvantages to the refinement of pleasure in a way that is incompatible with excess of any kind. In general, Hume connects balance and refined or innocent luxury in a way that favors moderate aristocracies characterized by sufficient wealth to enjoy an elegant life. On this central point, he's in sympathy with Montesquieu. In Hume's terms, the balance of power between the rich or high-born and the poor or low-born must be such as to prevent an excessive desire for luxury on the one hand and a lowering of aesthetic and intellectual standards on the other. You have to have that balance. In other words, Hume is an advocate of moderate progress in the acquisition of material comfort. To those of us who live in late modern industrial democracies, the proposals by thinkers like Montesquieu and Hume that are designed to preserve an age of elegance are not very realistic. Certainly, history has not confirmed the assumption that progress in commerce and in the arts and sciences will regulate one another in such a way as to preserve the virtue, political or moral, of the nation. On this point, Rousseau, I think, was closer to the truth when he denied a connection between elegance and learning on the one hand and morality on the other. Before I come to my conclusion, I would like to cite a famous essay by a Frenchman, Benjamin Constant, published in 1819, an essay on the difference between ancient and modern conceptions of liberty. I quote from Constant, "The aim of the ancients was the sharing of social power among the citizens of the same fatherland. This is what they called liberty. The aim of the moderns is the enjoyment of security and private pleasures, and they call liberty the guarantees accorded by institutions to these pleasures," end quote. Constant follows the typical view of the 18th century in connecting peace, the essential condition for the enjoyment of private pleasures, and so the mark of the superiority of the moderns to the ancients, to commerce. He follows the 18th century figures on that. His reasoning is at first quite odd, I think. I quote, "War is all impulse, commerce, calculation. War is impulse, commerce is calculation. Hence it follows that an age must come in which commerce replaces war. We have reached this age." This was 1819. The underlying thought, I believe, however foolish, is clear. Commerce will assimilate the martial spirit because it is pleasanter and more comfortable. Constant is thus unable to foresee that what he seems to regard as the end of history, understood as the saga of human struggle, is rather the dawning of a new era in which the inevitable failure of moderation in the face of increasing appetite and progress in the means of gratifying our desires will give rise to new wars of a magnitude and degree of brutality that the spokesman for comfortable virtue cannot even imagine. The final point that I wish to make, and this is very important to me, no one of you should take my analysis as a recommendation to jettison the modern conception of political and moral virtue and return to the doctrines of classical antiquity. Nor was it my intention to prepare for an invocation to the postmodern epoch about which we hear so much and understand so little. I hope only to have clarified the failure of the process by which the 18th century attempted to provide a moderate political version of the more extreme 17th century revolution against the ancients. I don't say that the goals of the modern revolution were mistaken or morally and politically inferior to the doctrines of classical antiquity, but something clearly went wrong in the formulation of the arguments and methods that were intended to support the modern revolution. I've centered my analysis this evening on what I take to be the false assumption that selfishness and the desire for comfortable self-preservation, although it leads to a deterioration of both political and moral virtue in the short run, results eventually in a more just and freer society than did the austere and martial sense of virtue represented by the ancients. This assumption is visible in the practical program with which Descartes justifies the advantages of the new science. It's an irony of history that the magnificent triumph of modern science and technology, and it is magnificent, should be the direct cause for impending disaster. I think if we're fair and objective about it, no matter how much we love science and technology, how much we owe to it, we have to see the ironic fact that it is, not because it intrinsically is evil, but because we can't handle it. It is the direct cause for our degradation as well as for our salvation. And that's just an irony of history. What we need, in my opinion, is not the abolition of science, which would be absurd, but a new program. That is to say, a new philosophy that is new only in the sense that it heeds the wisdom of the ancients as well as the rashness of the moderns. Among the principles of such a philosophy, we will not find the thesis of the centrality of greed or the short-sighted claim that commerce leads to peace and the progress of the arts and sciences. Despite their own moderation and elegance, Montesquieu and Hume fail to grasp, let alone solve, the political problem because their view of humanity is too low rather than too high. The result is a support for the relaxation of standards on the one hand and advocacy of a culture of spiritual aristocracy on the other. I hope to have convinced you that this balance is unstable. Thank you very much.
University professor Stanley Rosen presenting the 52nd annual University Lecture on Comfortable Virtue, some remarks on the Enlightenment. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoe with help from John Perotti and Boris Strapacki. Our web producer is Angel Cuzzelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.